is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to PocCast, a weekly audio dialogue between Pakistan and the West. We're podcasting from Seattle, Washington, USA on May 8th, 2007. This is Volume 3, Installment 12 of PocCast. I'm Ethan Casey, author of Alive and Well in Pakistan.
And I am Nasser Aziz, producer of PocCast.
And with us, as usual, is Asad Faizi.
Hello.
Plenty to talk about this week. Asad, you've been keeping up with events the last few days, which have been happening fast and furious on several fronts. What's up?
Well, our listeners probably know, who listen to us regularly, that we did a four-part series on judicial crisis, which concluded with a roundtable. Unfortunately, in Pakistan, the crisis did not end with our roundtable. And the crisis continues and becomes bigger and bigger.
Do you mean to say that the government of Pakistan and the establishment in Pakistan did not listen to and heed the warnings of what we had to say?
Those are two different things. They may be listening, but they're not heeding
anymore. I don't think they're listening to the right things. Yeah.
If only everybody would heed what we have to say on podcasts, the world would be a better place.
Absolutely.
But there's always a crisis going on in Pakistan.
Well, actually, this time, I'm not sure if it's a bad crisis. It's possible that it's a good crisis because...
It's an interesting crisis.
It's an interesting crisis, definitely. But it also, for the first time in Pakistan... As an outcome of this crisis, we are seeing judiciary becoming more and more independent and getting stronger and stronger every day and asserting itself, which is a very, very important thing. And as I have said in the past, that could have only be possible after the media was become independent and is now free and open. So I think we are moving in the right direction. And unfortunately, like everywhere else in the world, those changes are not always, very quiet, and sometimes they are very turbulent, and sometimes they are, they leave a large wake, and this is happening in Pakistan, and this last couple of weeks has been extraordinary in the history of Pakistan, at least in the judicial history of Pakistan.
Certainly the most telegenic, the most dramatic event of the past few days. And we're speaking today on, today is May 8th. So by the time this is, this installment of PocCast is online, it'll be a week from now. So who knows what will have happened by then, but we're talking about the events of Saturday, May 5th. What happened?
So a lot of the political pundits and analysts and journalists in Pakistan are now calling it the epic journey, where the Supreme Court Chief Justice started the journey from Islamabad, which ended up in Lahore, on the famous historical Grand Trunk Road, or GT Road, as they call it. And Nasir, as you know, it was actually originally built by Sher Shah Suri about some 500 or so years ago. And that's the lifeline, commercial lifeline in Pakistan. It runs through the most populous and the most prosperous Punjab province in Pakistan, and it has a lot of this population centers all along the freeway.
This is really the Punjabi heartland of Pakistan.
I would say this is the heartland of Pakistan, because this is, and Lahore happens to be the political nerve center of Pakistan and the legal nerve center of Pakistan.
So basically we're talking about the road going from Islamabad, which is really at the edge of Punjab, right near NWFP, right to Lahore, which arguably is the heart of Pakistan.
And this journey normally takes about 4.5 hours. It took the Chief Justice 26 hours, not because there was bad traffic, not because there was a problem, but because hundreds and thousands of people lined on GT Road all the way from Islamabad to Lahore and greeted him at every city and every small town and every village that he crossed. It was an amazing phenomena where people were actually standing for 26 hours, and it's very hot. I mean, you can, for those...
Yeah, this is May.
This is May. It gets extremely hot in Pakistan at this time of year,
in that part of Pakistan.
Especially in Punjab. So people stayed, waited for the Chief Justice for 26 hours in hot sun all night, and Chief Justice started his journey around 8 a.m.
So what was the significance of this journey? Was this a pre-planned journey? Was there any political...
Well, one of the news articles I read suggested that it was one of the biggest public events in Pakistan since Benazir returned to the country in 1986.
Actually, I think it was even bigger, because maybe the crowd that received him in Lahore was this comparable size as that of Benazir. Actually, they said that only three times in the history of Pakistan there was such a huge crowd. One, when Benazir in 1988, when she returned after Zia's death. Second time was when Nawaz Sharif returned to Lahore after a nuclear explosion, and he was given a warm welcome by the nation. And this is the third. However, there is no precedence of people lining up along the road, 100,000 people actually on the streets, and somebody taking 26 hours on a road that takes normally 4.5 hours.
It really seems
hours.
Quite an extraordinary thing.
And this road is like an interstate, right?
This is like a commercial hub.
But here's another point, Asad. This is not. There is also a motorway financed by the IMF or the World Bank, right? So, as I know from personal experience, you can get from Islamabad to Lahore faster on the motorway than you can on the GT road.
Actually, it's the same now. They both have been upgraded.
Okay. So,
the point
I would suggest is that the Chief Justice did not make an innocent choice when he chose to do what he did. One of the things I read also pointed out that, surely there are not so many lawyers in the Punjab that everybody lining the road was a lawyer. This is not only a movement of lawyers anymore.
Even the Supreme Court Chief Justice claimed that they were all lawyers.
So it is absolutely a political thing. And I think that his decision to do to go along the GT road was very much clearly a political decision and a slap in the face to the government.
Absolutely. And two or three things points that I have to make. One is that you're right, it was not only lawyers, and they're not hundreds of thousands of lawyers, in Punjab province. There were political party activists and also ordinary citizens which were lining up, which is the scariest part of the whole scenario for Musharraf, that ordinary average citizen came out of their houses and they were waiting for the Chief Justice. However, going back to your original point and going back to Nasir's question as to what caused this journey, was actually the Chief Justice was invited, because he is still the Chief Justice of Pakistan.
Invited to who?
Invited by Lahore Bar Association. To deliver a speech. And also it was invited by the Gujranwala and Gujarat Bar Association, which are on the way from Islamabad to Lahore, and on them.
I suppose those events were postponed or something.
No, not at all, actually. What happened is that that's why it took him 26 hours, because he started off and there were like more than 1,000 cars in his procession when he started off in Islamabad, and they just keep on growing as he was passing smaller cities and towns. The more and more people were joining them, and then he stopped at 4 or 5 different points. For example, he made a speech in Gujarat, delivered a speech to Gujarat Bar Association, then to Gujranwala Bar Association, and then he ended up in Lahore. And in Lahore, there were like hundreds and thousands of people on the streets. There were at least 20,000-25,000 lawyers when he actually entered the compound of the Lahore Bar Association and Lahore High Court building. It was packed with the lawyers, like 25,000 lawyers. The political workers and ordinary citizens were kept out because it was supposedly a lawyers' convention. And his speech, by the way, that he delivered personally all along, were very, very non-political speeches and he never mentioned his reference.
But on that point, if this is accurate, Musharraf called him the chief justice of the opposition, or words to that effect.
Well, not Musharraf, but his cronies. But I think this is just totally nonsense, because I think he is now really have taken the mantle of chief justice of the people of Pakistan.
Right, which I thought that was a very foolish thing for Musharraf's cronies
to say. Definitely.
And if you listen, also, was he given any government security protocols and all that?
So the government tried to sway him mm-hmm. by saying, well, you know, when he announced he was going to go from Islamabad to Lahore, on road, uh-huh. they said, well, we have concern about security, and there are like suicide bombers. You should really take a plane. And he said, well, security is your job.
Ziaul Haq took a plane in 1988.
Yeah, well, plus security, I mean, that's government's job, right, to provide security. So
what did he say?
He said, no, I'm going to go on road, and it's your responsibility to provide me security. If you do that, fine. If you don't do it, that fine. No, but no matter what happens, I'm going to take the road. Mm. And that's what he did. And if you listen to the speech that he actually made in Lahore, the topic of his speech was the role of Supreme Court in guaranteeing the basic rights of the citizens of the country, mm-hmm. and in which he actually said, the dictatorship is a thing of the past, and he said the history proves that states founded on dictatorship face destruction, and those who don't learn from the history, are bound to be destroyed. He made a very strong point, but but at no point his speech was political, or he directly made a reference to his reference or Musharraf or anything.
Now, we've spent, I think, close to 10 minutes on just this, which, and rightly so, because it's dramatic and it's important events. What's happening in the courts is pretty significant. And there have also been issues with some media shutdowns that we want to touch on. And then something extraordinary that the Prime Minister said in recent days.
And his Prime Minister and a couple of other ministers. So let's start from the court, happening in court.
Let's touch on each of those three things briefly, because we have limited time.
Sure. And so, just to give a context, Supreme Judicial Council is a constitutional institution which comprises of the sitting chief judges of the Supreme Court and High Court. But they have no power. They can only investigate if President sends a reference or somebody sends a reference. And they can then come up with their findings and send it back to the President. Supreme Court in itself is the most powerful constitutional institution in Pakistan, just like in US. And they have all the executive powers. Supreme Judicial Council has absolutely no executive powers. Now, with this context, as we all know, that the President Musharraf has sent a reference against the Chief Justice, Iftikhar Chaudhry, in Supreme Judicial Council, to which the lawyers of the Chief Justice has raised objection to its constitution, to its competence to hear the hearing, and also to the bias of some of the judges, and they filed the complaint to the Supreme Court, which is a much more powerful body. So last week the Supreme Court of Pakistan actually suspended the hearings, stayed the hearings of Supreme Judicial Council. And this is a major victory for the Chief Justice, because Chief Justice has been all along saying that this Supreme Judicial Council is not a competent body to hear the case. B, there are some issues with some of the judges sitting in the Supreme Judicial Council who are biased against the Chief Justice. And C, whether,
such as the judges who would stand to benefit in career terms.
Exactly.
And
C, what was probably the most important, was that the hearing was happening in camera, and Chief Justice was all along asking for an open hearing. Now, the bigger bench of Supreme Court of Pakistan has actually stayed the whole proceedings, and they have it's like handing over a victory to the initial victory to the Chief Justice. Now the hearing will happen in a full court, which is 11 judges
and in open court.
In open court, and it will hear all the objection raised by the Chief Justice. a lot of pundits, actually, a lot of legal minds in Pakistan think that that's the way out of this crisis. And so to them, it's really the light at the end of the tunnel.
Will this save Musharraf?
Not necessarily. Well, it can save Musharraf in a sense that, let's say, the Supreme Court, in about a week, they start daily hearings, an open hearing, where the media is also invited and everybody's invited, on all the issues raised by the chief. Let's say at the end of the day, after 4 weeks or 6 weeks, if they decide in favor of the Chief Justice, and they said, which I think they will, because all these charges are very frivolous, Musharraf will have a means to save his face. He can say, look, I've been saying all along that my role was just to take the reference that was given to me by the Prime Minister and hand it out to the and I have said all along that I'll accept whatever decision will come from the Supreme Court, and I'm very graciously accepting the decision. So he can really come out and say that.
Well, he can come out and say that, but he surely will be severely weakened in terms of real prestige.
Absolutely. He had actually blown it many times. A lot of people think that he should have really, as soon as this whole thing's blown into a big issue, I think Musharraf originally thought that he'd be able to brow down Chief Justice, and he'll probably pressure him or force him into resignation. Didn't happen.
And then he thought he could browbeat the media.
Then he said,
with the attack on Jio, which I think you were suggesting earlier.
That, yeah, it from all, everything that we have seen so far, the government in Pakistan, and Musharraf included, really like to have an independent and open media as long as they are
in their favor, right?
Yeah, they're in their favor and not speaking against them.
So, speaking of this epic march when Chief Justice was traveling from Islamabad to Lahore, you mentioned that MQM, which is a Mahajir Qaumi Muhaz, a political party, they tried to block all the live coverage for Jio TV or through the cables.
Right. So one of the government. So in the past, if we were to connect the dots, in the past, as Ethan was mentioning, the government directly tried to crack down the media, and they stormed Jio's office, they beat up the journalist, and they ransacked the place. It was caught on TV,
and it's on YouTube and Google Videos.
Yeah, and it was caught on TV, and Musharraf actually had to come and apologize. So now they're trying a different tactic.
They're going after the cable operators.
They're going after the cable operators, and in Pakistan, it's not like in US where they have two or three major cable operators like Comcast or AT&T. In Pakistan, there are thousands of small cable operators all across the country.
Right.
And so what happened is that they're now using MQM, which is one of their allies in the share of the government.
But pardon me if I'm wrong, but MQM is powerful only in Sindh.
And this whole thing happened only in Sindh, actually. Yeah. Wherever MQM was in power, like in Karachi, Hyderabad, Sakkar, they the government has used MQM, which is essentially a fascist organization. They've used them to actually crack down on the cable operators, threaten them, and make them stop broadcasting live coverage of Chief Justice. Actually, these cable operators, they came out and they said that they were told that as long as the Chief Justice journey is on, and the Jio, Aaj, and ARY, which three channels, well, many channels, but three of them were major channels who were showing the live coverage and second by second, and they said, as you know, like, you can only turn the channel back on once this whole thing is over. So they try to use their power, the goons, to actually crack down on the cable operators.
So the reason MQM is sympathetic to Musharraf is because they're both Mahajirs.
I don't think so, because why is PMLQ sympathetic to Musharraf?
I'm just asking.
Because they want power. Right? MQM has a history of latching on to the power.
But MQM does not have a very good track record. They are the mafia. They are the gangsters. They're the mobs of Karachi.
Are a coalition partner in the government.
And they were a coalition partner with Nawaz Sharif, and then there was a coalition partner with Benazir.
So they are opportunists. Is that
they are fundamentally opportunists. They have a vote bank in Karachi and Urban Sindh, And then they use that vote bank to latch onto the power, and that's their politics, essentially.
So this effort to quash the video coverage of events,
that didn't also work out very well, right?
Right,
because there
right.
was massive reaction against that as well.
Right. So in today's, as we I think discussed last week, you know, in today's world, and Nazar mentioned YouTube and
Google Video,
it really is very difficult, I think, for any state power to keep this kind of thing out of the media, because the media is so much harder to control than it was 10, 20 years ago.
Plus, media has a lot more credibility than Musharraf and the government and everybody.
And if there's any institution that's coming out of this crisis looking pretty good in Pakistan, I'd say it's the media.
And the judiciary.
And the judiciary, definitely.
Which is a good sign for Pakistan, right?
Which is an excellent sign for Pakistan.
If not quite so good for Musharraf.
Well.
Which is fine. He's just a person.
So very quickly, tell us about this what Shaukat Aziz said.
Yeah, so
we're almost out of time in this segment.
Sure. Interestingly enough, they tried to first stop the march or the travel of the Chief Justice. Mm-hmm. The police tried to do everything they can to stop Chief Justice. They couldn't. They put the containers on the road. They put the whatever they could try to do. That beat up people. You know, the tear gas people, the people still lined up. Then they tried to do this media thing, right? They tried to shut down the media, didn't succeed. And eventually, in their extreme frustration, now, the last night, the Prime
last
Minister...
Last night, Monday the 7th of May.
And Shaukat Aziz, the Prime Minister, and some of the federal ministers now started saying that, hey, the government has the option of imposing emergency.
Now, I think they were very careful about what they said. They didn't come right out and say that. They said, we don't rule out, or there are many options. This might, you know, this is...
Well, they were threatening, basically. Under
certain circumstances.
Yeah, what they were saying, basically, is that, hey, you know, if it goes out of the hand, we have this option to impose emergency.
Mm-hmm. So emergency is the first step before martial law?
Well, actually, like in every constitution in the world, like in U.S. constitution and Pakistani constitution, emergency is when government is allowed in special circumstances to suppress the civil rights of the citizen. This usually happens in case of war, some external threat, let's say some natural disaster like an earthquake or some famine or something like that. And so this is always a provision in the Constitution. And the government is now threatening to use that provision to suppress the civil rights of the people.
So this is I think, a sign of the desperation and, as you put it right aptly a minute ago, the extreme frustration of the government at this moment.
So does that mean that Musharraf is getting weak and his government, is he about to negotiate some power deals with other political parties? What does that all mean?
So it is very interesting that he has been in negotiation with Benazir for the last, you know, 5 or 6 months. Mm-hmm. And if you have been reading Benazir's statements before this judicial crisis happened, she was almost begging Musharraf for a deal. Mm-hmm. And Musharraf was playing with a very strong hand, and then he shot himself in the foot. And just a couple of days ago, Benazir made a statement saying that she's not going to accept Musharraf as president in uniform, but she will accept him as in. So essentially, it almost looks to me like
the tables have been turned almost.
Well,
right? We're getting there.
Yeah, we're getting there, but it almost looks like to me a very Machiavellian move by some of these Musharraf cronies in PMLQ, the current power structure, who wanted to hang on to the power, and they were afraid that if Musharraf goes and cuts a deal with Benazir, then they would be they would lose power.
So he got bad advice from these guys, basically.
Absolutely, I think they're getting bad advice, so that in the end, Musharraf deals with a very weak hand and ends up not negotiating with Benazir, and then they stay in power. I think that's what the game is.
But that's a risky game for both for them and clearly enough for the country as well. Stay tuned.
Talking about the epic journeys, Ethan, didn't you also make an epic journey to Boston from Seattle?
Yes, I did. As we've, I think we mentioned last week as well. I was, on April 7th, I was at a seminar at Harvard University on Pakistan and on the prospects for democracy in Pakistan, and it was an interesting day. I was on the last panel of the day, and I took the position, or took the opportunity to make some suggestions about what I saw and see as the upside of Musharraf's tenure as president. I have always believed that the coup was not particularly his fault, that he has been a relatively benign ruler for Pakistan. I know many other people believe that as well. Many don't, as you'll see in when you hear the hear the excerpts. What you're going to hear of the over the next few minutes is me and several other participants in this seminar at Harvard University arguing over the merits of Musharraf's tenure, and in particular his whether he has been good or bad for media freedom. The ostensibly liberal civilian faction in Pakistan, I mean the political, the civilian leaders, we all know are inadequate or are showing themselves, have shown themselves to be inadequate. If we agree that the military is the problem, which I'm not sure, which I think was up for debate today, what's the answer? Is it Benazir Bhutto? Is it Benazir Bhutto who could have returned to Pakistan 2 or 3 weeks ago and really made a statement and perhaps begun to lead a movement, if that was what she and others desired, but who chose not to? Or is it Nawaz Sharif, who before the coup that many of us decry of October 99, well before the coup, who I believe dug his own grave politically by taking on pretty much every other institution in the country, including the media, including the Supreme Court, including the National Assembly. I talked to Cecil Chowdhury, the great war hero, fighter pilot, in January 99 in Lahore, and he said, we were talking about precisely this, what Nawaz Sharif was doing at that time, and this is pre-Kargil. He said, this is precisely how a tiger becomes a man-eater. So if we want to decry the military takeover, I think we've all thought and talked about this plenty, but we need to look elsewhere as well, and not only at the military, for responsibility for the fact that Pakistan is under long-term military rule.
I'm not about to offend anyone, because I've spent a great deal of time in politics, and one of the things you learn is you don't try to offend anyone. But let me just say that I have to take serious issue with Ethan's narrative of Pakistan's recent political history. It is exactly what Aisha Jalal was talking about, the anecdotal approach versus the analytical approach. Pakistan's history did not start with Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto and Musharraf. Pakistan's history goes back farther. The founding generation of Pakistan, that was the political leadership, was disqualified by Ayub Khan on nothing like the charges that have been leveled against Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif. Then a second generation of politicians arose under Ayub Khan, and that generation was eliminated by Ziaul Haq. The third generation is now being called inadequate again. Why not let the people decide? If General Musharraf was so sure that what Ethan says, that we all know Benazir Bhutto is inadequate, let him. Why didn't he hold a free and fair election and allow them to participate and let the people of Pakistan vote into it? That's my first observation. I think that this is the drawing room narrative of Karachi, Lahore, and Islamabad, of the classes that want democracy but don't like the people who end up emerging from democracy in Pakistan. We have a serious problem. There are many Democrats in Pakistan who like democracy, but who don't like the people who get elected by democracy. So therefore, they come up with these convoluted arguments about how the circumstances and this and that. Now, I know everybody here knows my affiliations, and I'm still very sympathetic to Benazir Bhutto with all the weaknesses and the flaws and the inadequacies that I point out. And that's the disclaimer, so that nobody accuses me of, you're doing it with a purpose.
But at the same time,
may I make the point that politics is about contestation for power. Mm-hmm. And this elite that has emerged, that basically just goes and tells GHQ every few months or every few years what's wrong with the government and then seeks positions. Shaukat Aziz's role in the 1999 coup, inshallah, the book will come out 10 years from now when the papers are declassified. I have already spoken about the role of certain people in my book in previous years. This role should end. If the diaspora wants to play a role, it should be to augment and support the political forces that exist. If certain political figures, let me complete that. If certain political figures are inadequate, they need to be, that their inadequacy needs to be addressed through the political process, not by this game of undermining the political process.
And, well, one thing that has not been discussed really adequately here is the extent to which in those so-called 10 lost years, the decade, the lost decade, how many governments were shafted out, And how the political, I mean, how the state structure made it impossible for any elected government to operate without either trying to control all the institutions, i.e. the judiciary, or the parliament, and ultimately, in the case of this rather misguided prime minister called Nawaz Sharif, the army itself. And I think that is a function of the system that we've been trying to emphasize, and the view that because one is trying to foreground the military, which has most of the shots in its pocket, we are somehow ignoring the politicians and their inadequacies is completely false. I really think that there is consensus amongst a lot of the Pakistani observers, than more than we, I think, are prepared to acknowledge. And also, I think this view that we are somehow not acknowledging the Pakistani people, you know, who speaks for the Pakistani people? I don't. Maybe some of you think you do. But we are trying to talk about a way in which we can move towards a system that is fairer, and that gives them an opportunity to decide that their politicians are either good or bad. Let's complete, Pakistan has the an enviable distinction of never having completed one term in office, something that Bangladesh managed in that lost, I mean, in that lost decade. So, I mean, how do you, you cannot have democracy by turning the tap on and turning it off at the will of the powers that be, in this instance, the final arbiter, the military. Not that we just want to accuse the military. We are perfectly aware of the limitations of the politicians as a product of a system that is inequitable and based on an imbalance of institutions.
I'm not going to make apologies for Musharraf, but from the outside, from someone who is not only not living in Pakistan but also not Pakistani, I've spent quite a bit of time in Pakistan and lived in Asia for many years. I don't think he's necessarily, he or this present regime, given whatever the structures are, whether the structures are immutable or, in fact, whether they're reparable or changeable. Pakistan has had, there's been an upside to Musharraf's rule, and I don't think it does any it's necessarily a good thing to lose sight of that. I think
the upside is?
You know, I don't think...
Honestly asking a question.
Relative stability. He is a military man, but he is relatively liberal. He has, in fact, opened up some space, some liberal space, and certainly that's inadequate. But he is not Zia-ul-Haq. He has placated the United States during a very, very dangerous time in world history, facing a very, very dangerous American regime. I think he handled that situation very well. And he has allowed and even encouraged a free media.
Nina Buki, Halad Mersha.